and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question, please press star 1. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. It will also be available after the call to listen to a replay. If you would like to listen to the replay, you may dial 866-509-3700 or 203-369-1912. That will be available through July 6. I will now turn the meeting over to Dr. Diana Hadjibegovic. You may begin.
Thank you, Paula. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining COCA conference call. I'm glad to present two speakers for today's COCA conference call, Dr. Anna Lykos and Dr. Amy Sater. Dr. Anna Lykos from CDC joined the influenza division as a medical epidemiologist in July. Her current position in the influenza division is focused on the international aspects of influenza, especially influenza A, H5N1, infectious in humans, and she has had the opportunity to provide technical assistance to countries in Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa. Dr. Amy Sater is a veterinary epidemiologist with the National Surveillance Unit in the National Center for Animal Health Surveillance, within the USDA Animal Plant Health and Inspection Services. She's working in developing surveillance plan of animal disease of agricultural importance and preparation for detecting and responding to new emerging and foreign animal disease. Objectives for today's COCA conference calls are avian surveillance information and update, human surveillance information and update, information regarding clinical aspects, information regarding infectious control. Slides for today's presentation you can find on www.bt.cdc.gov/COCA. Dr. Lykos, you may start now.
Thank you, Diana. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I have to apologize. I really didn't know I would be giving this talk until yesterday, so I hope I'll cover most of the information that you're interested in. If you have the slides up, the first slide is my title slide, and move on to the second slide after you learn how to pronounce my name, which is Lykos. Before I begin, I'd like to do a brief background on influenza and clarify three terms that get used frequently and sometimes inappropriately. Seasonal influenza viruses are those viruses which circulate every year and are a public health problem that is found every year. These are viruses that we refer to as H3N2, H1N1, and H1N2 that are currently the circulating viruses that spread easily from person to person. These are to be distinguished from avian influenza viruses, of which there are many. The one that is currently of great interest is called H5N1. This virus is currently causing a devastating outbreak in poultry, and it causes severe but rare human infections. At this time, it does not spread easily from person to person. Pandemic influenza viruses, however, is referred to viruses which are new influenza A subtypes that are capable of infecting humans. They cause serious illness, and they spread easily from human to human. H5N1 at this time is a likely candidate, but remember, it is not a pandemic virus as yet. Next slide. As I mentioned, seasonal influenza is an annual public health problem. It has a substantial public health impact. Modeling studies indicate that there are 36,000 excess deaths each year, 200,000 hospitalizations each year. It affects 10 to 35% of children and 5 to 20% of adults, causing a substantial loss in work and school days. As well, medical care systems can be overwhelmed. Next slide. To review a bit about the science of influenza viruses, they are classified into three types, types A, B, and C. Only types A and B cause significant disease in humans. types B and C are limited to humans only. It's type A that can infect many species and in general causes more virulent disease. Next slide. Influenza viruses are in negative sense single-stranded RNA viruses. They are unique in that their genomes are divided into 8 segments that code for at least 10 different proteins. Two of these proteins are found on the surface and are called hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. Next slide. These two surface proteins are the major antigens for influenza. Hemagglutinin, which is represented by the spikes on the diagram shown, is actually the site of attachment of influenza virus to host cells. Antibody that is generated by the host to hemagglutinin is a protective antibody. The second surface glycoprotein is represented by the buttons and is called neuraminidase. This protein actually helps release virions from cells. An antibody from neuraminidase can help modify disease severity. Next slide. There are 16 different hemagglutinin subtypes, and there are 9 different neuraminidase subtypes. Each of these is capable of infecting or are found in either domestic wild waterfowl or shorebirds. If you look at the graphic, a water bird is shown amongst for all the hemagglutinin as well as all the neuraminidase subtypes. So the waterfowl provide a reservoir for influenza viruses in general, and you can see that a large number of different strains can be generated by recombining or reassorting the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase proteins. Next page. As I mentioned, wild waterfowl are the natural reservoir, and they are a true reservoir in that the virus usually does not cause disease. However, the birds are capable of shedding virus through their respiratory and gastrointestinal secretions and feces. The viruses can survive at low temperatures and low humidity for days to weeks in the environment. Next slide. Typically, avian influenza viruses do not jump species, and they usually do not infect people. They are classified by their subtype, the H number, N number, as well as their pathogenicity in chickens. They're either called high-path or low-path avian influenza virus, which is dependent upon the molecular sequencing of the hemagglutinin gene region, as well as whether or not they kill chickens when injected into them. Next slide. The current epizootic caused by H5N1 has been really unprecedented in terms of the number of poultry that have either died from infection or been killed in culling events. Just since 2003, when the current epizootic began, in 2003, only 2 countries reported H5N1. In 2004 and 2005, 7 new countries in each of those years reported it. But since the beginning of 2006, over 30 countries now report the presence of H5N1 in their bird populations. Next slide. The virus in the birds does continue to change as we're tracking it. It now causes disease in wild birds, as noted by die-offs at the Qinghai Lake in China. It has asymptomatic infection in domestic ducks, but it's also been found to cause infections in cats as well as pigs. It has in sequencing the virus, we now know that there are 2 virus clades that are present in birds. If you go to the next slide, it shows the phylogenetic tree for these, and you'll see some blue letters that match the blue countries of Vietnam and Laos, Thailand, and then the green clade is China and Indonesia. This is clade 2, and this is currently the clade that has been moving into parts of Eastern Europe and Africa. Next slide. Now, human infections with avian influenza have been noted in the past. With low-path avian influenza, which typically you will not see any poultry die-offs, we've had cases of conjunctivitis and influenza-like illness. caused by types H7N7, H9N2, and H7N2 in years 1996 through 2003. Typically, disease in humans with low-path avian influenza viruses is very mild. High-path avian influenza viruses also cause human infections prior to the current situation with H5N1. In 2003, the Netherlands reported a large outbreak of 89 cases that was caused by H7N7 influenza A virus. As well as in 2004, Canada had two cases caused by H7N3. The next slide actually summarizes our outbreaks with both low path and high path. And if you look at the column entitled cases and compare it to the column entitled deaths, you'll see that in general, infection with avian influenza viruses, whether low path or high path, tends to be rather mild illness, with the exception of the current H5N1 situation worldwide. And the next slide, I'll be showing you the countries that now have human cases of H5N1 infection in humans. The first cases were ever described were in 1996, 1997 in Hong Kong. Hong Kong took the radical approach of killing all chickens within Hong Kong and effectively stopped the transmission of avian influenza to humans. And we saw no further H5N1 until 2003, when Vietnam, near the end of 2003, began reporting cases. Now, the boxes that will appear will go in order of countries that have reported human cases, but the numbers in the boxes are their current cumulative numbers of cases and deaths. So Vietnam, though they had their first cases in 2003, currently have had 93 cases with 42 deaths. This was followed in 2004 by Thailand, who has had 22 cases and 14 deaths. 2005 saw Cambodia, Indonesia, and China reporting human cases. In 2006, we've now seen cases in Turkey, Iraq, Azerbaijan, Egypt, and Djibouti. To total 228 cases with 130 deaths as of June 20th, 2006. This gives you a case fatality proportion of 57%. As I mentioned, as of June 20th, 2006, 228 cases, 130 deaths reported from a total of 10 countries. And this sounds like a lot, but it has to be put into the perspective that millions of people have been exposed to poultry during this time frame of 2003 to 2006. So this is actually a very rare event. The cases are sporadic. There have been occasional clusters reported. And in most cases, people had either touched or directly handled sick poultry. There have been a few cases of probable limited human-to-human transmission, first reported in Thailand, and then most recently a family cluster has been reported from Indonesia. All countries that have reported human cases have also reported poultry outbreaks as well. Next slide, please. This slide shows you the comparison of how influenza A is transmitted. Regular or seasonal influenza is transmitted through respiratory droplets that are generated from coughs or sneezes, as well as by contact transmission as you move the virus from a surface to your own mucous membranes by contaminated hands. In contrast, avian influenza is transmitted by direct or close contact, that people are actually touching sick birds, or in the cases of human-to-human transmission, it's thought still to be due to touching people and then touching one's own mucous membranes to effect transmission. Next slide. The H5N1 does not appear to replicate in the same location as regular seasonal influenza, which typically replicates in the nasal pharynx or upper respiratory tract. In March of this year, there were two reports, one in Science Express and the other in Nature, that indicated that H5N1 preferred to attach to cells located in the lower respiratory tract, such as type 2 pneumocytes, alveolar macrophages, and terminal bronchial epithelia. Next slide. The people that have been infected with H5N1 have ranged in age from 1 to 81 years. However, it does tend to affect the younger age groups. Previously healthy children and young adults have been susceptible. The incubation period appears to be a little bit longer than regular seasonal influenza, and we're generally accepting a range of 2 to 10 days, although one case reported may have taken up to 17 days from exposure to symptom onset. Because of the preferential replication in the lower respiratory tract, throat swabs appear to be a better specimen for isolation of H5N1 viruses for testing, and I'll be covering this in a little more detail in a subsequent slide. Next slide. In the papers listed at the bottom of the slide, clinical features have been described for several patients that have had H5N1 disease. Patients still tend to present with fever of 38 degrees centigrade or higher, and either cough or shortness of breath. Diarrhea, however, which is not seen frequently in adult seasonal influenza, does appear to have a more prominent role in H5N1 illness. As I mentioned, lower respiratory tract symptoms develop earlier. Clinical suggestions of pneumonia, and x-rays will show multifocal consolidations or atypical type picture suggestive of a primary viral pneumonia. Frequently, patients will progress and worsen, requiring mechanical ventilation. Lymphopenia and thrombocytopenia are frequent. Patients will have multi-organ failure, including both renal and cardiac dysfunction, as they progressively worsen. The next slide shows chest x-rays taken from a child in Vietnam in 2004, showing this rapid progression of pulmonary complications, a pulmonary pneumonia, going from this patchy infiltrate on day 5 to almost complete whiteout on day 10. Next slide. The treatment for H5N1 is obviously supportive care and antivirals, the preferred antiviral being oseltamivir. Broad-spectrum antibiotics should also be added to cover for secondary pneumonias. Other possible therapies may include corticosteroids. In some countries, other immunomodulators have been tried as well. Not a lot of data exists as to their efficacy, however, at this time. Next slide. Human clusters are important, and these are defined as 3 or more persons that have the onset of severe respiratory illness within 7 to 10 days of each other, and an epidemiological link to a suspected or confirmed case of H5N1. The causes of a human cluster are many, or are several. There could be from a common source exposure, or different exposures at different times coincidentally, or they could be a sign of human-to-human transmission. So obviously, investigation of human clusters is important in terms of determining the individual's occupation, any behaviors that are risk factors for infection, as well as environmental exposures. Investigation should also include a virological component. Next slide. The paradigm for intervening to prevent H5N1 infection really focuses firstly on controlling outbreaks in poultry. And for this reason, human health authorities and animal health authorities have needed to work very closely. In terms of human health, we want to do surveillance for severe respiratory illness. We want to, if bird cases have been identified and reported, then we want to look hard for any human cases in that same area. Additionally, when severe pneumonia without an etiology is diagnosed, then you'd want to look for any risk factors such as contact with sick or ill poultry and think about H5N1 infection. All cases should be isolated as well as actively investigated as noted earlier. And then obviously you want to protect the occupationally exposed, including healthcare workers and also poultry workers and those who are doing the culling work. Next slide. So who should be tested? This information is actually taken from a health alert network issued by the Influenza Division on June 7th, and a subsequent slide will have the website address to get the whole document. But the people that should be tested are anyone with an illness, severe pulmonary illness that has required hospitalization and or is possibly has been fatal, and this individual has had a documented fever of greater than or equal to 38 degrees centigrade and has pneumonia on chest x-ray, acute respiratory distress syndrome or other severe respiratory illness with no alternate diagnosis, and meets one of the three colored boxes, A, B, or C, within 10 days of symptom onset. Box A is for a history of travel to a country with H5N1 cases in either birds or humans, and the individual has either had direct contact with sick or dead poultry, had direct contact with surfaces contaminated with poultry feces, has consumed raw or incompletely cooked poultry or eggs or other poultry products, has had direct contact with sick or dead wild birds that have been either suspected or confirmed to have H5N1, and or they have had close contact of a person hospitalized or dead due to a severe unexplained respiratory illness. Criteria B is simply close contact of an ill patient confirmed or suspected to have H5N1, and C is a possible laboratory accident in someone working with live H5N1 influenza virus in their laboratory. Additionally, cases can be considered for testing on a case-by-case basis by clinicians in someone that has either mild or atypical disease, so the severe component is missing, but they meet either criteria A, B, or C. Or someone that does have severe fatal respiratory disease, but for whom the epidemiological information is uncertain. This could be a returned traveler that you don't know about their exposure, or a person here in the States who's had contact with either sick or well-appearing poultry. Next slide. If you want to collect samples, then the first thing to do is to be sure to notify your local or state health department that you think you have an H5N1 patient in your facility. The state and local health department epidemiologists can provide you with materials as well as a great deal of information and assistance. The samples to collect, as I mentioned before, are going to be from the lower respiratory tract, an oropharyngeal swab, a bronchoalveolar lavage, or transtracheal aspirate are preferred. We would accept nasal or nasopharyngeal swabs, but be aware that these may contain less virus and you may get a false negative as a result. The swabs to be used should be Dacron tip swabs with either an aluminum or a plastic shaft, and they should be refrigerated immediately after collection. Swabs should be collected within 3 days of illness onset if at all possible. But we have found that serial samples over several days or multiple samples from multiple sites on multiple days is actually of benefit. Of course, if the sample collection method is one that generates an aerosol or is likely to generate an aerosol, then an N95 mask as well as gloves and gowns should be worn. Rapid tests are not very useful in this setting. They have a very low sensitivity for H5N1, reportedly from some work done in Vietnam. The negative result does not exclude a diagnosis of H5N1, and a positive result obviously does not distinguish between seasonal flu and H5N1 infection. And as I mentioned, this information on the previous on this slide as well as the previous two can be found in a document entitled Updated Interim Guidance for Laboratory Testing of Persons with Suspected Infection with Avian Influenza A Virus in the United States. This is a Health Alert Network publication issued on June 7, 2006, and can be found at www.cdc.gov/flu/avian/. Next slide. So pandemic viruses, as I mentioned earlier, are new influenza A subtypes that can infect humans. They cause serious illness, and they spread easily from human to human. H5N1 has met the first two prerequisites, but not the last. But keep in mind that each new human infection is an opportunity for the virus to change. Next slide. In summary, H5N1 will not be eradicated soon. The virus does continue to change. H5N1 influenza has met two of the three requirements for a pandemic, but opportunities to meet the third continue as long as human and bird infections occur. Next slide. In the meantime, what you can do is to get vaccinated, to practice and teach and encourage good hygiene, including good cough hygiene as well as hand washing, and to stay informed. Next slide. Thank you for your attention, and I'll turn this back to Diana.
Thank you, Dr. Lyak. That's great information you gave us. Dr. Sato, you may start now. Dr. Sato, we can't hear you.
I believe she's disconnected. One moment.
Thank you.
Her line disconnected. We'll wait, see if she calls in. One moment. I wonder if she knows she's disconnected.
We'll try to contact her. I'm sorry about this, but for our listeners, please keep your questions for end of this conference call. And for those who wouldn't have a chance to ask a question, you can always email to us, coca@cdc.gov, and we can make sure to answer your questions.
Hi there. This is Dr. Saito. I'm sorry I accidentally disconnected when it was my time to talk.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Great start, Dr. Saito.
All right. Get my presentation up again because I seem to have lost that as well. Okay. Good afternoon. You know, as was mentioned in the previous talk, avian influenza has entered into high intensity spotlight as concerns about pandemic flu with the advent of human infections by the high path H5N1 Asian strain that is currently being detected in several continents. At least 50 countries in Europe, Asia, and Africa have detected high path H5N1 Asian strain in wild and or domestic poultry. The current outbreak, as was previously mentioned, is of extreme proportions because it's affecting millions of birds. My presentation today is more for an educational presentation to discuss avian influenza and really the USDA's perspective on it, and I'm not going to focus just on high path H5N1. So in the agricultural community, we're certainly having concern about avian influenza because worldwide in the past several years there's been a sharp increase in the number of avian influenza outbreaks compared to the previous 40 years. The impact on the poultry industry has increased about tenfold, And from 1959 to 1998, avian influenza outbreaks had impacted about 23 million birds, whereas from 1999 to 2004 alone, over 200 million birds have been affected. So on the first slide that I've got there, that just is a slide I took off the pandemic flu site just to show where the countries that the H5N1 strain has been found. So let's move on to the next slide, please. I won't go further too much into detail on the background since Dr. Leica gave such a great introduction to it, but as we all know, influenza is an orthomyxovirus, and type influenza A has been the one that's infecting birds, but also swine, horses, humans, and some other mammalian species. There have been a couple of type C strains that have been identified in pigs and dogs, but they don't really generally cause infection in those species. The USDA is really concerned about influenza strains detected in other species and not just the birds. In swine, only H1N1 and H3N2 have been detected. However, swine influenza viruses are transmitted to humans relatively frequently, and this hasn't led to human epidemics, but certainly some swine influenza viruses have occasionally been detected in people or isolated in people with respiratory illness. As it was previously mentioned, there are 16 hemagglutinin and 9 neuraminidase glycoprotein surface proteins that are the major antigens on the virus. And so therefore, in avian influenza, there are a possible of 144 different subtypes based on the H and N combinations. And in addition, within these different combinations, there are also different strains that are possible. So really, the possibilities of what's out there is really unknown, and it's a really high number. The strains, as was previously discussed, are identified as either low pathogenicity or high pathogenicity avian influenza. And the pathogenicity is based on the strain's ability to cause illness and the degree of illness or death in domestic poultry. The diagnosis of the pathogenicity for official control purposes has been established by the World Organization for Animal Health, or the OIE, on the basis of three criteria: in vivo testing, molecular determinants, and hemagglutinin typing. So far, only H5 and H7 have been identified as highly pathogenic avian influenza. Next slide, please. Although the actual source of infection to poultry populations and outbreaks are rarely identified, wild birds, particularly waterfowl and shorebirds, are considered the reservoirs. Unlike human, pig, and horse influenza virus strains, which undergo antigenic shift and genetic change, AI strains are pretty much in evolutionary stasis within their wild bird hosts. And so these strains are fully adapted to the birds and generally cause no clinical signs. As Dr. Likos mentioned previously, all H and N subtypes have been detected in wild birds. On the slide, I accepted H13 only to indicate that all 16 H subtypes have been detected in waterfowl, except for H13. However, all of the H subtypes have been detected in wild birds, waterfowl, or the shorebirds. Transmission between birds is primarily by direct or indirect contact with fecally contaminated aerosols, water, feed, and other materials. Excretion of the virus from birds is primarily in the feces, although aerosolization of nasal secretions can also lead to transmission. And as was mentioned earlier, the virus can survive in water for many days, and so therefore, fecal material in water is a very efficient mode of transmission in wild waterfowl. In addition to these modes of transmission, AI can be also detected and found on the outer surfaces of unwashed eggshells. So transmission can actually occur farm to farm by transferring contaminated eggs. Vertical transmission via egg transmission has never been demonstrated to occur, but eggs laid 3 to 4 days post-infection have actually been shown to contain virus. The big concern that you all are probably here today for is the zoonotic potential of avian influenza. In the past 50 years, avian influenza virus has caused sporadic infections, and the risk factors have included post-direct contact with live or dead infected birds, and these are the poultry veterinarians, poultry farmers, and family callers and the folks like that, and exposure to live poultry in the live bird market system. Now, as far as consumer risk, there is no epidemiologic evidence to support the possibility of infection by consumption of raw or undercooked blood, organs, or meat. So, and it is also important to note, as was mentioned earlier, that most avian influenza virus strains found in wild birds have not been found to represent a public health risk. Next slide. This slide is just an adaptation from something from Dr. Webster, and it's just to demonstrate the mechanism under which avian influenza virus can cause poultry infection and can lead to poultry mortality events. And the virus is likely transmitted to poultry through exposure to wild birds, and this can occur in backyard flocks or outside range poultry operations and things like that. And then through a breach in biosecurity, it can enter into the larger commercial poultry operations. Most avian influenza in domestic poultry that are detected are low path, but given the right circumstances and mutations, it can mutate into highly pathogenic form. And generally, the first signs of it is seen in that picture on your right, where all the chickens are generally found dead. These clinical signs are for avian influenza in general and not specific to the high-path H5N1 strain that everyone is concerned about these days. As I mentioned earlier, avian influenza virus is well adapted to wild birds, so generally no clinical signs are seen. However, this has changed with the H5N1 strain that's causing the mortality and illness in wild birds abroad. In domestic poultry, a broad range of signs can be seen. In low path or mild forms, no signs may be seen. And if signs are seen, they may include increased respiratory rate, gasping, depression, edema of the head, face, comb, and wattles, cyanosis of unfeathered skin, diarrhea, inappetence, tremors, paralysis, and decreased egg production. In high pathogenic forms, generally the first sign is sudden death and high flock mortality rates. Next slide. If you keep clicking on the slide, there are actually three maps on this slide, and all this is to demonstrate the broad distribution of the domestic poultry across the U.S. continent with some concentrated areas of production. So the first one is the number of turkeys, second map is the number of broilers and other chickens, and then the third map is the number of layers that are in the United States. Not included in these maps are populations of domestic waterfowl, game birds, exhibition birds, and other non-turkey, non-chicken domestic bird populations. Kind of give you an idea of the size of our poultry populations. I'm going to kind of quote some numbers to you. In commercial production, a census, so to speak, of birds that were on hand when these numbers were calculated, in 2005, there were 256 million turkeys across the United States. 2004, there were 8.74 billion broiler chickens. And December 2005, there were 290 million egg layers. In addition to the commercial flocks, there are approximately 9,000 game fowl breeders in 34 states, over 26,000 duck farms maintaining about 3.8 million birds, over 17,000 goose farms maintaining about 173,000 birds, almost 5,000 pheasant farms maintaining 2.27 million birds, over 4,400 pigeon and squab farms maintaining about 450,000 birds, and over 3,700 quail farms maintaining about 4.9 million birds. So as you can see, the emergence of or the arrival of high-path avian influenza, whether it's a H5N1 strain or another high-path strain, this can have huge impacts on the poultry industry in the United States. Next slide. Excuse me. In the United States, avian influenza in domestic poultry is mostly found in turkeys, and these are obviously the low pathogenic form. And prior to 1983, the greatest losses due to avian influenza was due to the loss of breeding and laying efficiency in turkey breeding flocks. In the United States, there have actually been three high-path AI outbreaks, and I have inadvertently left out a 1924 event from this slide. And that 1924 event was due to an H7 strain that affected live bird markets in four northeastern states and the poultry mortality during that event ranged from 50 to 100%. In 1983, 1984, this is kind of the big high-path AI outbreak that they teach all of us veterinary students about during vet school. And this was one that was caused by a high-path H5N2. And this high-path actually had a precursor low-path H5N2 strain that was in circulation in the poultry population for about 6 months prior to the outbreak that occurred. And this outbreak led to the destruction of 17 million birds. And if we adjust the costs to more current levels because of inflation, this outbreak led to major economic losses with over $85 million in losses to the producers, over $490 million in cost to the consumer, and over $85 million for the eradication efforts. Finally, the third high-path event in the United States occurred more recently in 2004, and this was due to an H5N2 that likely evolved from a low-pathogenic H5N3 that had been detected in 2002. Quick response and scientific advances, such as the development and availability of a rapid diagnostic test kit, led to quick containment and eradication, and the outbreak was contained to one non-commercial flock of 6,600 birds and to live bird markets with direct ties to that flock. Currently, the U.S. is considered free of highly pathogenic avian influenza. Next slide. The OIE, or the World Organization for Animal Health, is an international animal health organization that helps countries coordinate animal disease information and decrease the potential for epidemics. The OIE has, as of June 2004, 166 member countries, and the OIE provides surveillance guidelines that international trade partners have agreed upon to protect their respective industries and to avoid unjustified trade barriers. And so U.S. compliance with these standards certifies that we practice acceptable sanitary measures and this assures our trading partners that our poultry and poultry products represent negligible disease risk. And because of this, our programs for AI detection have been carried out to meet these standards. The OIE has defined notifiable avian influenza as any H5 or H7 strain of AI, regardless of its pathogenicity, as well as any other AI strain determined to be highly pathogenic. And as I mentioned earlier, this is based on in vivo testing, molecular diagnostics, and hemagglutinin typing. All H5 and H7 strains, even the low-path strains, are reportable because of their potential to become high pathogenic strains. Surveillance and control and elimination of all notifiable avian influenzas is essential for us to maintain our free international trade for the poultry or commercial poultry industry and to eliminate production losses due to infection. Next slide, please. APHIS, or the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, has been working since the 1980s, if not earlier, with federal and state partners and industry to safeguard the health of U.S. animals against avian influenza. And we have really three goals to our avian influenza surveillance. First is early detection of notifiable AI, whether it's the H5N1 or any other notifiable strains, to assure that H5 and H7 low-path outbreaks do not persist in poultry populations, because that would be presenting the risk of developing high-path strains in our poultry populations. And finally, to demonstrate the absence of notifiable avian influenza in our country. Next slide, please. On a broad scale, there are really four likely modes of the entry of avian influenza into the U.S. agricultural community. The first one being importation of live animals or animal products, and this is legal and illegal. Currently, we ban importation of live poultry and poultry products from countries that have been identified as having high-path avian influenza, particularly H5N1. All live birds that are imported are quarantined at USDA-approved facilities for at least 30 days and are tested for avian influenza. all hatching eggs are quarantined at USDA-approved facilities until 30 days post-hatching. AI testing has occurred on, or AI testing is done on these eggs only if they come from countries not considered free of another important poultry disease, being exotic Newcastle disease. We certainly realize that we still have some potential risks for it being brought into our country, one being the illegal smuggling of poultry and poultry products. There are two other potential risks that we also are most concerned about, the one being receiving shipments from countries that we consider to be free of the exotic Newcastle disease. They have lower requirements as far as restrictions for bringing birds into the U.S. And really, these countries may have epidemiologic ties to areas that have high path avian influenza. And then the second one being importation of product from infected country or their neighbors. And again, this could be from a smuggled item, or it can occur by mismanifested ships. And this can occur when shipments are rerouted through IPATH AI free areas. If these birds enter flocks for a minimal time period, they could be represented as being from a free area and reshipped. Second possibility is incorrectly identified shipments. The third being entrance of virus via contaminated conveyances such as boxes and crates. We certainly considered the possibility of importing swine products as a potential route of entry, and we really don't, at this time at least, see this as a likely route because many regions of concern at this time are not free of another important swine disease, classical swine fever, and therefore little product from these countries are allowed into the U.S. anyway. And zoo animals, they are imported in, and sometimes they come from areas that may be of concern. And these are really, although these are something that we are monitoring, it's not considered to be as likely of a route because zoos have a very vested interest in their exhibit animals, and so therefore they really closely monitor their animals. So if it was to come in with a zoo animal, I think that we would be notified relatively quickly. Second potential route of entry would be human movement, and this is again legal or illegal, and this is by an infected person or person wearing or bringing contaminated clothing or other materials into the country and transmits it to a poultry population. Third one is mechanical transmission, and this is something that I've already alluded to earlier with the contaminated conveyances and the human travel. And finally, the biggest route that we've all been hearing about and concentrating a lot of efforts on is introduction by migratory birds, particularly waterfowl. And this is because wild birds serve as the natural reservoir, and they don't really follow any defined boundaries per se, and we're unable to restrict their movement. Next slide. There are really three risk factors that we see as things that we need to take into consideration as far as risk to our poultry populations and how much surveillance that we may need to implement at these facilities. The first one being the biosecurity practices at that part of the poultry operation. Is it following an all-in, all-out management where all birds come in together and no bird is introduced, and then all of the birds are taken to slaughter at the same time? Other practices is removal of all organic material and cleaning and disinfection of houses between flocks, poultry contact with potential contaminated equipment, or with other animals, including wildlife, pets, and livestock. Is public access and pedestrian traffic within the facilities, and the showering and the uniforms that are changed before entering each house. Second risk factor being the type of premises. Generally, poultry that are exposed to wild birds are at greatest risk for acquiring avian influenza, and these include the open range operations, backyard flocks, hobby flocks, and other flocks that may have a pond or waterfowl habitat on premises. And generally what we find within our commercial industry is that they have very high levels of biosecurity, and they really have minimal, if any, exposure to other animals or to wildlife because, again, it's a vested interest and it really, they do it for the protection of their industry. And finally, the third risk factor is location of the premises. Is the premises located along a major flyway? Is it near breeding in or watering areas for waterfowl and other kind of factors such as that? Next slide, please. We have several modes of our surveillance, the first three being our primary modes of our surveillance, but we also have other things in place as far as detection and keeping avian influenza out of the country. Within our veterinary services, we have a program that's the ASEP, which is standing for the Aquaculture Swine Equine Poultry Programs. And within this program, they have a low-path AI H5-H7 program. And this program was initiated in the mid-1980s as part of the National Poultry Improvement Program for the commercial poultry. And the National Poultry Improvement Program originally established standards for overall evaluation of breeding stock and hatchery products for freedom from hatchery-disseminated diseases such as pylorum. Low-path AI H5-H7 was added because of these two subtypes' potential to become highly pathogenic, as well as to meet OIE requirements to maintain our international trade. So far, monitoring programs have been established in all 48 continental states, and all primary breeder and commercial multiplier flocks participate in the program. And so this means that we've got 4,866 meat-type chicken flocks, which represents about 71 million birds, 597 turkey flocks representing about 5 million birds, and 184 egg-type chicken flocks representing about 3 million birds. In addition to the chicken and turkey flocks, we've also got over 3,800 game bird breeder flocks participating in the program, and this includes waterfowl, exhibition birds, and other poultry. And this represents about 1.47 million birds. Currently, there is an program expansion into fancy fowl as well as backyard flocks and other populations that may have not participated previously. In addition to the National Poultry Improvement Program, we've also the live LPAI H5H7 program was expanded into the live bird marketing system in the 1990s when it was found that the live bird marketing system may serve as a reservoir for avian influenza. And in the Northeast U.S., there are about 120 markets that sell about 25 million birds annually. In the live bird market system, there are three components in the system. There are the producers, the distributors, and the markets. And from each of these three components, bird and environmental samples are collected on a regular basis and tested for avian influenza. Currently, there are 22 states with live bird marketing monitoring program established, and at least there were in 2005, and it is expected that we're going to expand that into 8 more states in 2006. As far as the non-poultry surveillance efforts, such as swine and other domestic species, we currently aren't planning any active surveillance plan. We're going to rely more on passive, as it has occurred in the past, where where investigations are initiated when there are suspect cases. And the primary reason why we're not doing more active surveillance is because primarily of a lack of a validated test for these samples, particularly a rapid diagnostic test. Most of the tests that are available have been validated for poultry only. The second component of our surveillance program include wild bird surveillance, and this already kicked off earlier this spring, as most of you already know. And USDA Wildlife Services worked together with the Department of Interior and state agencies to help each state develop a wild bird surveillance with targeted surveillance of apparently healthy wild birds of specific species based on the local geography, the wildlife ecology, and agricultural populations. And in addition, as part of this surveillance program, Wildlife Services and Department of Interior are working together into investigation of wild bird mortality events and wild bird reporting that is going to occur. And as well, the Department of Interior has some other components within their surveillance, which includes testing of hunter-killed birds and other things like that. Our third component is being undertaken by our animal care program. And these animal care has jurisdiction over zoos and other similar facilities. And they've been working with the American Zoo Association institutions as well as non-AZA facilities that fall within the animal care jurisdiction. And this is to establish effective surveillance plans on their premises. And so far, the zoos have actually received approval by the USDA to implement vaccination of exhibit birds of particular concern, primarily the threatened and endangered species. But participating facilities will undertake both active and passive surveillance of apparently healthy exhibit and wild birds on their premises. AZA zoos already perform diagnostic analyses on all animals that die in the grounds, and AI testing is planned to be included among those tests performed. Fourthly, I'm going to kind of mention something that I've already mentioned earlier. Our National Center for Import and Export is responsible for the importing and exporting of all agricultural products. And so they are responsible for the quarantining of all live birds and hatching eggs. And so all of live birds are tested for avian influenza, and then some of the hatching eggs are as well. And the National Center for Import and Export bans the imports of all birds and eggs from high-path avian influenza H5N1 countries. Fifthly, our smuggling and interdiction and trade compliance program works closely with CBP as well as other agencies to monitor the importation of animal products and ban importation of all products from high-path H5N1 countries. They conduct risk management and anti-smuggling activities to prevent the unlawful entry and distribution of prohibited agricultural commodities and products. Because of the elevated situation, they are targeting domestic products likely to have illegally imported avian products, as well as targeting shippers, distributors, and importers thought likely to import such products. They are concentrating their efforts on shipments not only from identified countries with high path H5N1, but also on countries on shipments from countries through which the shipments may have been rerouted. And in addition to this, the program is currently testing an internet monitoring system that's going to focus on potentially contaminated product being advertised on the internet for sale. Sixth, our Center for Emerging Issues has a task force that kind of serves as the veterinary services eyes and ears outside of our usual information channels. And these are really to examine the external environment to identify emerging events, whether they are animal health related or societal and industry trends. And this is done on both a national and international scale. The primary component for this task force is electronic scanning of information, where information on the internet is filtered and potential patterns are identified. And analysts are able to simultaneously search, sort, compare, visualize, map, cluster, and perform link analysis on thousands of documents from many different sources. And the program attempts to utilize this information to anticipate impacts of these events on animal and public health and on veterinary services program objectives and operations. So if a mortality event is reported somewhere that for whatever reason has not yet been reported to the USDA, you know, this could serve as USDA's initial flag that high-path AI, whether it's H5N1 or another strain, has arrived and we have further investigation. The last two bullets that I have on this slide is talking about the Animal Research Service, which isn't part of the APHIS at all, but we kind of work together on our avian influenza efforts. Southeast Poultry Research Laboratory actually developed the rapid screening test, which is an reverse transcriptase PCR that is currently being used for surveillance testing of most of our animals that's in our program. And any samples that are confirmed as high PATH H5N1 by NVSL would be subsequently sequenced by the Southeast Poultry Research Lab to determine its relatedness to, for sequencing, to determine its relatedness to Asian strains or any other H5N1 strains. In addition, Southeast Poultry Lab is participating in a number of studies looking at wild bird to poultry transmission, the development of enhanced vaccines for birds, developing and evaluating techniques to predict which low PATH forms may become high PATH forms, and in collaboration with the CDC, evaluate the recombinant vaccine to ensure that human vaccination doesn't lead to poultry disease, and finally determining the risk of avian influenza in poultry meat and the ability of pasteurization of egg products and cooking of meat to kill high PATH AI. And the CSREES, or the Cooperative State Research, Education, and Extension Service, has provided funding for research at various institutions for wild bird sampling and testing as well to sort of augment what APHIS has already planned. Next slide, please. This is just to kind of give you an idea of how things are kind of centralized within the USDA, and that anything that really is a suspect, avian influenza, whether it's low PATH, high PATH, H5N1, or any other avian influenza strain, it really does come through, has to go, really come through the USDA. And I'm going to kind of talk about the various labs before I go on to NVSL as well as ARS. The NALN is the National Animal Health Laboratory Network, and these consist of the veterinary diagnostic laboratories around the country. And the purpose of this network is targeted surveillance for early detection of a disease outbreak and for demonstrating freedom of disease and response testing for foreign animal diseases, which includes high PATH avian influenza. The test that they're using for avian influenza surveillance is the RRT-PCR on cloacal and oral swabs. And they're scheduled to perform tests for the live bird marketing system, wildlife services, zoos, and other animal care facilities. The labs that are in the network are approved laboratories that are trained by NVSL and have passed proficiency testing. Currently, I think there are about 47 labs that have been approved, and these are in 40 states. Another group of labs that are going to be, that are used as part of our program are the National Poultry Improvement Program Laboratories. And these laboratories are public and private laboratories that are around the country, and they perform serologic testing on poultry samples, and this is done by ELISA and or AGID, and this is primarily for commercial flocks. The approved laboratories are trained by NVSL staff as well as proficiency tested. Currently, there are 65 labs in 31 states. Now, in addition to the NALN and NPIP doing testing, the Department of Interior National Wildlife Health Center is doing wild bird testing as part of surveillance, and as part of other research projects, research laboratories may also be performing testing outside of the formal surveillance program. Now, all positive samples from NALN, NPIP, or other laboratories must be sent to NVSL for confirmatory testing. And NVSL will actually perform the subtyping as well as determine the pathogenicity. In addition, NVSL does test all of the samples that are taken from the live birds as well as hatched eggs in the quarantine facilities. Animal Research Service, Southeast Poultry Research Lab, and NVSL do work together very closely in development of diagnostic testing as well as in the confirmatory testing. NVSL will confirm avian influenza and subtype, and initial sequencing will be done here to determine whether the mutation at the cleavage site is present, but complete sequencing for genetic relatedness is really going to be done by the Southeast Poultry Lab. And in addition, Southeast Poultry may also receive samples from various research projects that are going on. The next slide, and this is going to be my final slide, I believe, yes. So you know, our response is really going to depend on the situation. In general, the USDA, we establish incident management teams, we initiate response, and we take measures to control and eradicate an outbreak. Our response and communication is of the situation is and will be done in coordination with other federal and state agencies, as well as the industry. The actual response as far as other actions are going to really vary depending on the situation under which the detection occurs and on the FE investigations, and those would be primarily the trace backs and trace forwards. And at a minimum, the premise or the facility from which the infected bird or sample came from would be quarantined, and movement off-site would be restricted. Infected and surveillance zones will be established, and follow-up testing and monitoring of flocks on premises will occur, as well as enhanced wild bird surveillance in that area. Other actions may include movement and restriction of poultry and poultry products within the zones, depopulation of affected flocks, and cleaning and disinfection of premises. And should the measures that are being taken, that are taking place, not be felt to be sufficient, vaccination of poultry may occur. And again, this is all done in coordination with various federal and state agencies as well as industry, because we want to have a consensus on what are the appropriate actions and to ensure that cooperation is going to occur. And so I'm going to thank you for your attention at this time and just, you know, emphasize that for us, we've been monitoring for avian influenza for many years now, and the emergence of the H5N1 Asian strain, in our minds, we're not going to really be treating it that much differently than we would any high path strain that's detected. We certainly consider a high path avian influenza to be something that would warrant rapid response, as any high path avian influenza event would, but our activities in general would probably not change that much as far as the veterinary response. So thank you very much for your attention, and I will turn it back over.
Thank you, Dr. Sater. This was an excellent set of information. Now it's time for questions and answers. But before we start this session, regarding any media questions, please direct them to the Office of Media Relations. Let's give a chance to our clinical audience to ask questions. Let me just one more time repeat for those who will not have a chance to ask questions today. Please email to us at coca@cdc.gov, and we will make sure to respond to your inquiries. And one more information, next week, transcript and audio recording file of this of today's COCA conference call will be posted on the web. Website address is www.bt.cdc.gov/COCA. Now, Paula, I can turn to you.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Sandy Rock. Could you please state your organization?
Advanced Med Hanford.
You may ask your question, sir.
In the first presentation, the very last slide, it was rather cryptically noted that vaccination was important, and I think that needs to be elaborated on a little bit.
Yeah, this is Anna. Thank you for your question. Vaccination for routine influenza is we're always encouraging that people get vaccinated in the appropriate recommended groups. The seasonal influenza vaccine is available and should be used appropriately. In the face of H5N1, we try to encourage vaccination just to eliminate the possibility of a hypothetical risk of mixing of H5N1 with seasonal influenza in a single individual, sort of what we expected to happen in pigs, or have been taught that pigs were the mixing vessel in the past.
So in general, influenza, seasonal influenza vaccination is a good thing, and in specifically, it can help reduce the risk of generating a pandemic virus through reassortment of the gene segments.
Thank you.
Terry Yamauchi, do may I ask a question after you state your organization?
The University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences and Arkansas Children's Hospital. My question is, there's some concern about development of antiviral resistance in this virus, and I wondered if that has been seen in any of the individuals who have passed away from this infection.
Yeah, this is Anna again, and there has been reports of antiviral resistance. And the adamantanes, there is occasional resistance that is shown with the clade 2 viruses. It was present in clade 1 as well. It appears to be spontaneous. It's my understanding that in some cases within the same country, and cases that are temporarily associated, not from a common source, but a country that's experiencing multiple cases, that one isolate will be sensitive to the adamantanes and another can be resistant. Oseltamivir resistance has also been reported, I believe, two reports of three cases that clade 1 viruses were resistant to oseltamivir, I believe. I'm not aware of any clade 2 yet that have been reported.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Janine Waltman. Please state your organization.
Glen Cove Hospital. I was wondering, on the CDC website, the interim recommendations for infection control in healthcare facilities is under revision. And I was wondering if you have any idea as to when that will be posted, because the WHO recommends droplet precautions, where the CDC still is recommending airborne. I was wondering if you know if we're going to be going with droplet or airborne precautions.
Yeah, thanks. The new guidance should be coming out soon. It's my understanding it's been through clearance, and I don't know exactly where it's been held up. You're correct that there's been some discussion about airborne versus respiratory droplet precautions. I spoke with our infection control people this morning. And what I'm expecting to have a recommendation for is actually the more conservative approach. And we know that in general for clinicians, for healthcare workers that are doing procedures to patients thought to have H5N1, that the procedures would generate an aerosol, we recommend a respirator, an N95 respirator. The situation is we really don't know what's going to happen with this virus as well as a pandemic virus, be it H5N1 or any other virus. So it's certainly reasonable in a situation where you have very close contact providing care or to a patient that an N95 respirator could certainly be worn in that situation. I hope that helps. Keep checking the website. It should be coming out soon.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Gary Ades, please state your organization and ask your question.
EHA Consulting Group. When you're making recommendations for employees returning to work, should they ever get this disease, what would the length of time be after cessation of symptoms?
Good question. I'm trying to search my memory bank here. Could you send that question in an email? What comes to my mind immediately is 21 days, but I'm not sure that that's correct. So could you just send an email to the COCA, and I'll find that and send it back to you with the right answer?
Sure, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Our next question comes from Elaine C. Please state your organization and ask your question.
I'm from New Heights Clinic. The question is about math. A previous answer had alluded to using N95 masks for healthcare professionals taking care of patients with close contact. How about for the following three groups of people? One, say receptionists, nurses, other healthcare providers. The second group is people potentially infected with H5N1. And the third group of people is patients infected with H5N1.
In terms of anyone that you know is infected or you suspect to be infected with an H5N1 virus, it is not appropriate to put an N95 mask on those individuals. A surgical mask is actually more protective in preventing the spread of the virus. Rather, if you put a surgical mask on someone who is ill, is a much more appropriate use of it. In terms of receptionists, and I didn't quite hear the other group, the second group of people that, could you repeat?
Healthcare personnel in a clinical office. And the second group was people being evaluated for influenza.
People being, I'm sorry?
Evaluated.
Evaluated for influenza. Well, as a physician, taking a throat swab from somebody that is coughing, I know I would want to put an N95 mask on. That the viral particle, you're up close to that patient, you're in front of them, you're in the line of fire, so to speak. So I would encourage the use of appropriate protection. In terms of other people, as I said before, I think that when there are certain procedures that are being done known to generate aerosols or at least have a higher risk of generating aerosols, then the N95 mask is a better form of protection. Providing patient care, in direct close patient care, N95 protection can be considered and can be used. If resources become limited, and basically, when resources become limited, however, you have to start prioritizing your use of masks. And so I would limit probably the N95 mask to those procedures known to generate aerosols that could possibly infect a healthcare worker. Those are the things that need to be thought about in terms of what somebody would be wearing.
Thank you.
Peter Rabinowitz, please state your organization and ask your question.
Hi, Yale Occupational and Environmental Medicine Program. I had another question about occupational aspects of avian influenza. For clinicians who are providing occupational health services to people who may be at risk, either lab workers, poultry workers, healthcare workers, any recommendations forthcoming regarding medical surveillance, either at baseline or periodically, any other special issues in working with these populations?
I'm thinking on that one as well. I know that the local health departments, the state health departments, I would imagine, if H5N1 arrives in the United States, would establish some kind of active surveillance for those individuals that are taking care of patients. So that may be more appropriately answered through your state health department. If you'd like, you can send an email as well, and I'll follow up on that question in more detail.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Will King, please state your organization and ask your question.
Franklin County Health Department. The question is, has the CDC and HHS and WHO, have they took a proactive look on how many regiments of Tamiflu has the CDC purchased, and are you going to include that antivirals and oral suppressions into the SNS program?
Yes, the Strategic National Stockpile has been collecting doses of Tamiflu as well as other medications. I don't have the current count as now. I believe it is can be found on the pandemicflu.gov website.
Our next question comes from Michelle Shung. Your line is open. Please state your organization.
My question was answered. Thank you.
Richard Davis, please state your organization and ask your question.
Randolph County, West Virginia Office of Emergency Management. My question relates to surveillance. Recently in the news, it was announced that a gosling in Prince Edward Island was suspected of dying from H5N1. Now, this occurred some time prior to June 16th, and it took until somewhat after the 20th and several different responses from various labs in Canada. First it was positive, then it was negative. Now the Canadian government says there was no sign of H5N1. My concern is about surveillance. When we see diagnosis coming from poultry in Indonesia or places like that, they immediately are sent to Hong Kong or to the naval lab in Cairo, Egypt, and generally within 48 hours we have a reliable diagnosis. Is anything being done on that front to make the surveillance diagnoses more readily available, more quickly performed, and more accurately performed?
Are you talking about in the birds, then, you're talking about?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, you know, currently we have the initial screening, the PCR, which we have results within 3 hours. And with our communications plan being what it is, I mean, we generally will send out a notice that there has been a preliminary H5. And within its arrival to NVSL, we can pretty much determine within a few hours by PCR whether we can confirm it as H5 or not. And as well, we also have an assay to determine whether it's N1 or not. We certainly wouldn't consider it confirmed until we've done the full virus isolation and the official subtyping through the inhibition test as well. And primarily the reason we have to do that is, one, we want to make sure that our diagnosis is correct, because, two, you know, that certainly there are trade implications. So, you know, if we have an event that occurs as H5N1, we can have some preliminary data that or preliminary announcement, but it certainly wouldn't be confirmed any faster. It really depends on how the kind of specimen that comes in, how much of it grows in culture, and basically what are we going to be able to do as far as confirming it using our standard protocols. If it's something that gets into the poultry industry, I can tell you that generally the first sign are the birds are going to be dead, particularly with what has been seen with H5N1 in these other countries. And certainly the poultry industry in general and a lot of states in general don't wait until that confirmatory test is done before they take action. As soon as they suspect that it's avian influenza, particularly H5 or H7, they will have a response plan, and they probably will, particularly if it's something that they suspect is high-path AI, they will depopulate before the testing is even confirmed.
Thank you very much.
Barbara Ryan, your line is open. Please state your organization.
Yes, Clark County Health Department, Washington State. I have a question. You said the Dacron, want wet and dry or both? Ever been isolated in urine culture?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? You're breaking up, and I didn't get all the words.
I'm sorry, is that better?
Yes.
Okay. My question is about the testing on the Dacron swab. Do you want a dry or wet or both, and has it ever been isolated in urine?
To my knowledge, it has not been isolated in urine. However, what labs are doing across the world, I don't know. But I really don't think it has been isolated in urine at all. That would be reported rather quickly. And in terms of a wet or dry swab, that's a good question. I think a dry swab is adequate as long as you get the oropharyngeal areas well swabbed, or even deeper if possible.
Well, the PCR can be done quicker on a dry as a screening, but wet for culture. So I'm just wondering if you're asking for both.
We'll take both.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Lazar Gomez. Please state your organization and ask your question.
Miami-Dade County Health Department. I am concerned just because all the measures, the quarantine, establishes its own limit movement of the poultry and product, depopulation, vaccination, and all those measures have been applied in other countries and other situations. What is that we do or will do different than Europe and Asia to prevent the spread of the disease among the bird? That is my first question.
I think the first thing to address that is that our operations here are very different than it is in Asia. Certainly we are very limited by the reporting. I mean, certainly if an operator chooses to not report to us, then we're not going to be able to do anything. But it is very dependent on it being reported and being allowed access to take care of it. But I think that based on activities in the past, and we certainly have facilities and laboratories set up all over our country where we can handle over 20,000 samples a day to have this rapid response, I think that in that sense we are set up a little differently, not to mention we have a whole slew of not only the people who are in the USDA agency, but we've got emergency response volunteers as well as other resources to fall upon. And so I think that our situation is a little bit differently just by how our industry is set up.
And the second part of my question is, if we know that we won't have enough anti-flu, and we know that we don't have enough vaccine, and we will not have enough vaccine in the near future, why is that we spend so much time and money and resource on anti-flu and vaccine when the population is being kind of left out in education and prevention? Less than 10% of the resource is being put toward the education and prevention, and that really caught my attention at this moment.
Are you talking about the human vaccination?
Yes.
Okay.
I appreciate your comment and concerns. I agree with you that simple procedures such as hand washing and teaching good cough or respiratory hygiene are extremely important and sometimes not given as much value as they are certainly worthy of. I am always interested in the question of how to protect healthcare workers, and yet as a physician I know that physicians are not as good at washing their hands as they could be, and we're not that good at getting vaccines either, the influenza vaccine ourselves. So I certainly encourage us all to think about that and to promote these good habits.
But why is that we don't invest on that in education to the population? We spend at least less than 10% of the whole amount that the government is spending on the possible pandemic. Less than 10% is invested on population education. And that is wrong, because we need to make people aware of what's going on and how to protect them, how to prevent, and until we make sure that they have the least possible education to prevent the spread of the disease when they come, because we know it will come sometime.
I appreciate your concerns.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Samuel Grimari. Please state your organization.
Exelon in Chicago. Just a clarification on personal protective equipment in a corporate setting. If an employee presents himself or herself to, let's say, a human resources professional or an occupational nurse with flu-like symptoms, are we recommending again, I understand the N95 masks if there's going to be droplet formation or close procedural contact. How about, and I think it wasn't really clear what the previous questioner was talking about, receptionists, let's say call center personnel or not people on the phone, but let's say tellers in a bank or live reception personnel. Are we recommending that those people have surgical masks at hand if they're exposed to someone that has a fever and, let's say, wants to go home because they feel sick?
Well, obviously, anyone that feels sick or has a fever, especially if you think it is influenza, even seasonal influenza, I certainly encourage those people to stay home and to separate them, to remove them from infecting, the possibility of infecting other people. In terms of specific recommendations for non-healthcare providers, I really am afraid I'm going to have to defer to our infection control specialists. I'm not aware of any specific recommendations that have been made for those individuals. And it's unclear to me if you're talking about H5N1 infection as we know it today or if you're talking about a pandemic possibility. And
we won't know at the time. Let's just say that there is a spread of a febrile flu-like illness, and we're not sure if it's H5N1 or some other virus. Well, let's just say we're in the middle of an H5N1 epidemic. Are we recommending that people that are exposed to other folks in the workforce that, you know, inappropriately are at work and are sick? Let's just say I'm at work and I go to the occupational nurse and I feel sick and I want to go home. Does the occupational nurse have to wear an N95 mask? She's not going to have really close contact to do a procedure, or let's say a teller at a bank or someone at the electric company that is processing a bill payment from an employee. Are those people, should they have surgical masks at hand?
I hate to waffle on you, but I also hate to give out wrong information. I honestly don't know the answer to your question. I don't believe that specific recommendations have been made for those individuals. But I would ask that you allow me the opportunity to check with the people that have been working more on the issues of infection control.
Shall I email you?
That'd be great.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
Our next question comes from Steve Timmerman. Please state your organization.
Brookings Hospital in Brookings, South Dakota. And my question is with the antiviral medications. We, oseltamivir is one that's actually talked about most, but there really aren't any clear guidelines on what dose we need, how long to dose it, will people need to be redosed in a second or third wave? Because as we talk about strategic national stockpiling or any stockpiling, a lot of people think of Tamiflu in the box that it comes in where it has a five-day course and may think that's a dose to cover somebody, but it may not be adequate. So are there guidelines that are addressing that?
There, people have been looking at that issue, and at this time, as far as I know, in current cases of H5N1, the question of using a higher dose than the usual dose of Tamiflu has not been really borne out to be true. A longer duration of treatment may be warranted, and that would have to be a clinical judgment.
So as we're assessing stockpiles, though, do we say we have doses based on the five-day course we use for seasonal influenza, or how do we know how many people we can treat with what we have?
For a pandemic?
Right. If we detect in the United States today that there's avian influenza and there's a concern about prophylaxing our healthcare workers because people may be showing up at our facility, How do we dose them and for how long?
You would dose them with a regular, if I were the clinician, I would start them on the regular dose of Tamiflu and assess at the 5-day period as to whether it should be continued or not.
And what, how do you assess them? What's your criteria?
Are they getting better?
Well, we're prophylaxing our staff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about treatment.
No, prophylaxis. I mean, that's the whole idea, as I understand it, is, you know, we have the stockpile to move out partially for treatment, but also we want to prophylax our workers so that way they don't become infected and we're able to still utilize them to help treat the sick.
Prophylaxis that I'm aware of has been used in cases of people having direct contact with H5N1 cases. And the prophylaxis has been at the usual dose and has been extended for periods of time. Again, in terms of the numbers in the stockpile and how that covers that, I'd really have to talk to the SNS folks themselves.
Okay.
Thank you.
We have time for two more questions.
Our next question comes from Lillian Dayton. Please state your organization.
Yes, the Pasco County Health Department in Florida. I just wanted to address the gentleman's concern from Miami-Dade. Our health department has a program where we go out into the community and we talk to people about hand washing. We talk to people about preventive measures. We give flu shots. When our supply is up, when it's down, we start talking about ways they can prevent it. So this is something we've been doing for 7 years on a federal grant. And we're real proud of that, and I am assuming that most health departments across the country, because of the shortages of the vaccine, were doing the same thing. I just wanted to let you know that Florida is doing this, and that gentleman was from Miami-Dade, so I'm assuming they have the same awareness as we do, as all health departments do. We've always been into prevention in health departments. It has not been neglected. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
And our last question comes from Don McAllister. Please state your organization.
Independent research and a clinician with CDC. The question is, in the event that we do have a pandemic outbreak, would there be any efficacy in human consumption of raw plant material that's high quantities of succinic acid in them?
I'm unfamiliar with that.
Well, just for instance, a company in Canada has been experimenting with extracting succinic acid from different pine needle-type trees. Succinic acid is in the plant. Can a human consume the plant and gain any protection?
I am unfamiliar with that work.
All right. Thank you very much.
You might just email that question to caca@cdc.gov, and we will try to find the answer for you.
Thank you very much. I will.
Good. On behalf of CDC Commission Communication Team, I would like to thank everyone who made this CAUCA conference call possible. Please stay tuned for our next CAUCA conference call. And until next time, thank you, everyone. Goodbye.
This concludes today's conference. If you would like to listen to the replay, you may dial 866-509-3700 or 203-369-1912. That will be available through July 6th. Thank you. This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.